Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Columbia Gas executives face congressional scrutiny of their disaster management.
This company deserves an F. They have let down the people of Merrimack Valley. They put safety last and profits first.
Also today, newly released court documents give a behind-the-scenes look at the Tsarnaev trial, and some of the new information actually seems to contradict what we saw from Jahar in court.
He wanted people to know when he stood up in that court that he did this, and there should never be any more doubt about that.
And NASA's latest mission to Mars.
This is the first time we've had a mission that's truly dedicated to learning about Mars to its core, which is important not only to learn about Mars, but to learn about Earth as well.
Is there life on Mars?
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Columbia Gas says all Merrimack Valley residents displaced by the gas explosions in the region will be back in their homes by December 16th. Executives of the company made that commitment at a congressional hearing held today in Lawrence, called by Senator Ed Markey. Markey and others grilled the leadership of Columbia and its parent company, NiSource, calling on the company's CEO to resign.
I'm not sure that you should be allowed to continue to be the CEO of this company, given what happened. I think it is absolutely imperative that there be some price which is paid for what has happened.
In a few minutes, we'll speak with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, who was one of the lawmakers asking questions. But first, we speak with WBUR reporter Simone Rios, who has just returned from Lawrence. Simone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much, Cal.
So Senator Markey called for this hearing, but there's already an ongoing federal investigation into what happened. So what was the focus of today's exercise? What were lawmakers hoping to find out from Columbia and the community?
So first of all, it really wasn't your typical congressional hearing. It was, you know, in a high school or middle school gymnasium. It was in the middle of the community that was impacted. That kind of thing doesn't happen every day. The committee includes Senators Ed Markey, Elizabeth Warren, Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire, as well as Representatives Seth Moulton and outgoing Representative Nikki Tsongas. Lori Trahan was also there, who's the incoming representative. They were trying to get more answers on what actually happened on September 13th, but also pinning accountability on the leadership of Columbia Gas and its parent company, NiSource. The beginning was sort of the, you know, the executives coming up and reading off of their prepared testimonies about how saddened they were with the loss of a life and for everything everybody's experiencing. Up in Lawrence and Andover and North Andover. But the really compelling stuff came after that part. The two company leaders there had to respond to direct questioning from the Congress members. Here's Senator Ed Markey again addressing NiSource President and CEO Joe Hamrock.
Given what's happened, given this catastrophic event, do you think that you should be any longer allowed to run this company, given the catastrophe which has occurred?
Senator, the consequences alone of this tragedy motivate me to dedicate the remainder of my professional career to ensuring that nothing like this ever happens again.
So not resigning, Simone?
No, not resigning.
What else did members of Congress bring up today? I mean, they were calling for a shakeup at the top, but what other complaints did they raise?
There were a number of things. They were all critical of what they saw as a failure in communication leading to the gas disaster, and a refusal to take responsibility for it after the fact. Here's New Hampshire Senator Maggie Hassan.
There have been safety incident after safety incident after safety incident just here in Massachusetts, and it does not seem to have changed your culture. And that is of grave concern, because this can't happen again. It's 2018 in the United States of America, and nobody should be worried when they come home at night that their house is going to explode.
And that seemed to be a point that really resonated with people there, because that's what happened to them. You know, when they least expected it, these systems that are generally dependable all of a sudden were blowing up all over the region. And, you know, this, I think that, that point in particular really resonated with the people who are there today. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton criticized Columbia Gas President Steve Bryant for the long delay between the first explosions and the company coming out and saying anything about them.
On your website, you posted a notice at about 9 o'clock that evening, 5 hours, 5 hours after the two alarms were received by your facility, that there is a, quote, incident in the area, and that customers should make themselves safe. 5 hours. That does not strike me as a culture of safety among your employees or at your organization.
So it went on like this for a long time, really kind of a courtroom setting, the senators coming at these executives pretty hard. Senators and House members, you know, lobbying criticisms, and company officials kind of meekly apologizing.
So a lot of tough questions for Columbia today. What else did the company executives say? I mean, did they take more responsibility? Did they talk about concrete changes that they're making going forward?
They did. I would say under pressure, no pun intended, Hamrock and Bryant repeatedly said they take full responsibility for the recovery and even what led to these explosions. And they did say that in accordance with industry standards, they don't always have professional engineers working for them and making the decisions on the ground. But they say they are striving to abide by that guidance now.
And not just guidance if the governor gets his way, right? Charlie Baker wants to make that a requirement going forward.
Exactly. Baker filed a bill in the wake of the disaster that would mandate that natural gas engineering plans bear a stamp of approval of a certified professional engineer. Seems to make sense, but that's not the case, and that's not the industry standard, as these executives pointed out today, particularly when this work could pose a risk to public safety. As far as other changes in the company, officials said today they're going to improve communications and install automatic pressure control equipment. They also say they're going to put in remote monitoring devices that can shut down systems from control centers, like the one in Ohio, which got 2 overpressurization alerts the day of the disaster.
And Simone, I know that the compensation of these executives came up today too, right? For sort of obvious reasons. I mean, a disaster happens on their watch, and yet they're bringing home big salaries nevertheless.
Well, yeah, Elizabeth Warren was there, so you might expect she would bring up CEO pay. But in response to Senator Warren's questions, NiSource CEO Joe Hamrock said he'd asked for his bonus to be withheld. Columbia Gas President Steve Bryant said he would not accept a, quote, significant proportion of his pay incentive. Hamrock, by the way, makes $5 million a year, most of that in the form of incentives. Bryant said he makes just over $500,000.
I do want to get to one other, I thought, really powerful moment from the hearing. And this was when we heard from the sister of Leonel Rondon. She was talking about losing her brother. What was that like, Simone? And then we'll listen to a little bit of that testimony.
It was powerful. I mean, it really hits home when you're sitting in front of the person who lost a family member. Leonel sounded like a wonderful guy, and there were long periods of silence in between her words. Let's take a listen.
We will not have the joy of seeing the wonderful man we know he would have become. I stand in front of you in his honor. I will never have my brother back. But we hope there will be justice for him in the community.
So when you listen to that, Simone, I mean, the room must have just been silent. But what else could you read in the room? I mean, did you get a sense of confidence? I mean, the company has pledged a December 16th time for everyone to get back in their homes. Did you sense skepticism, or were people feeling like, yeah, that's really going to come through this time?
It's tough to say, given the fact that they missed the previous deadline, which was November 19th. In the case of Ed Markey, he said that he absolutely did not feel like anything has changed. But he said this will be the first of multiple reckonings the company will face. For Senator Warren's part, she said after the hearing that Columbia is now on the line to get people's gas flowing by that December 16th date.
Everyone will be back in their homes by December 16th. We got it on video, and there were no ifs, ands, or buts. They committed. So we need to hold them to that.
All right. So there's very clearly going to be some strong oversight of that commitment going forward. That's WBUR reporter Simone Rios. Simone, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Kellen.
All right, I want to turn now to Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. She represents the 3rd District of Massachusetts. That includes the cities of Lawrence and Andover, which were both heavily impacted by those gas explosions in September. And, of course, she was at the hearing today, and she joins us now from her office in Lowell. Congresswoman Tsongas, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
So, you know, I was in the Merrimack Valley just last week to see some preparations for the 23,000 Thanksgiving meals that Columbia Gas was supplying to customers. And Congresswoman, there were mixed feelings, to say the least. I mean, I think people appreciate the effort to make things right, but they're also frustrated by the pace of recovery. I mean, some of those families receiving the meals were initially told that they'd have gas in time to cook their own Thanksgiving dinners. So what's your level of satisfaction with Columbia's recovery work?
Oh, you know, one cannot ever be satisfied until every family is back in their home. And yes, the Thanksgiving meal was lovely, as I understand it. But we all know that holidays are best spent in our homes, and people had, you know, really hoped that that would be the case for Thanksgiving. And given today's testimony, and as you just heard from Senator Warren, they committed today that everybody would be back in their homes by December 16th. So our job is to make sure that the company does as it's pledged to do. But I do know there's an element of skepticism, rightfully so. People hoping for the best, but, you know, preparing for the worst. But I do hope that the company, given its statements today, honors its promise and does everything it has to do. Because in the end, it's about the company providing the resources to make sure that that date is met.
You know, we heard some from Senator Markey earlier talking to Joe Hamrock, the chief executive of NiSource, which owns Columbia Gas, openly questioning whether he's still fit to lead the company. Seth Moulton also questioned the company's leadership. In fact, calling directly for Hamrock's resignation. So, Congresswoman, do you also share those concerns about Hamrock's leadership in the future of NiSource?
Well, I share concerns about the nature of his leadership, and as others asked today, about the culture of a company that really did not put safety first. You know, I asked a question of Mr. Hamrock if they had a disaster response plan in place. And he said, yes, oh, we do. But when Mayor Rivera got up and talked through all that did not happen in the immediate aftermath of these events, it's very clear that whatever plan they had in place hadn't been looked at, if ever. And they really scrambled to find a way forward in reaction. And some of the reaction times that were talked about are indicative of that. Their failure to communicate is indicative of that. The fact that first responders had to play, in any event, would play a critical role. But in this event, had they not played the role they did so well, this could have been so much worse. So all these things are indicative of, you know, very, very poor leadership.
Yeah, I think that question about the disaster management or disaster plan stood out. But I also was struck by the exchange, Congresswoman, that you had with Joe Hamrock about whether he could guarantee that the costs would not be passed on to ratepayers going forward. And it didn't sound to me like he committed to that. What is your reaction?
I was frankly astonished, honestly, given that we'd had the conversation about executive pay and the wonderful salary that he makes, and then not to be able to pledge that people from very modest means who are struggling in the aftermath of this disaster with its impact on their homes, their livelihoods, their children's lives, that they could not make the simple pledge not to pass the cost of dealing with this disaster, which should never have happened in the first place. I also had asked if they accepted the findings of the National Transportation Safety Board, which in essence said this should never have happened in the first place. So, number one, it shouldn't have happened. It did happen because of failures within their company. And given that, that alone, I think, would warrant their not passing on the cost of dealing with this to the ratepayer. But that's compounded by the fact that, you know, their executives are really heartily rewarded.
Yeah, I think to put some detail on that, we've seen SEC filings that show Hamrock made more than $5 million in total compensation last year. He did say that he would give up his incentive pay for the coming year, but even his base salary was about $1 million last year, just to give you some perspective. Congresswoman, what about safety going forward? You know, we heard from Hamrock emphasizing that the top concern always has been and will in the future be safety. Do you take that as a sincere commitment from him?
Well, I think pledges are very pleasant to hear, but a pledge like that is easy to say. What the company does in the long run is really more important. So the oversight role of Congress will have to really play a major role in making sure that we hold their feet to the fire, number one. Number two, I think we have to look at the regulatory framework and see where there are lapses in that create too many loopholes for companies to go through and in the end compromise the safety of their customers. So it's a multifaceted effort, I think. Number one, just watching what a company does, number one, but number two, also being sure that the regulatory environment is up to the task and that the regulators, are really playing their role and not too cozy with with those they're regulating.
Congresswoman, would you support then the governor's proposal that Simone and I were discussing a moment ago? That's Governor Charlie Baker has proposed a new rule that would require gas companies, when they're doing work that could pose a public safety risk, to have a professional engineer approve all of those work plans. That is not the case right now. Is that the kind of oversight you're talking about?
Yes, and that's something that a state can take at, and our state, our Commonwealth, is obviously doing that. But I think at the federal level, what we would have to look at is whether or not there should be such a uniform requirement, so that even though we might have that requirement here in Massachusetts, there may be other companies that other states that don't have it or have even a lesser regulatory environment. We'll have to look at creating uniform standards so that people everywhere can be comfortable in the safety of their homes and know that the gas it's making its way into their home to heat their houses and warm their water is not going to do harm.
So just as a status update, as of this weekend, there were still more than 1,000 families living in temporary housing. Congresswoman, what do those people need most right now?
Well, what they need is a confidence that by December 16th, the company will do what it said it will do and make sure that everybody is back in their home. I happened to have a conversation today with a young woman. She and her son are living in a motel in Chelmsford, which is not a terrible distance from Lawrence, but still some inconvenience. And, she was taking it with good humor, but as best she could. But nevertheless, it's been a long time that people have had to live like this. And I think, as Mayor Rivera said so well, it's really a testament to the character of the city that people are trying to put as good a face on this as they can. But it's coming at great cost to them and to their families and to their livelihoods. And the company needs to understand that. And having said today that December 16th is a drop-dead date, we want to make sure that that's the case.
So, Congressman, I do want to ask you about another bit of news. From over the weekend, we saw quite a scene at the southern border where U.S. authorities closed off a port of entry temporarily at Tijuana. And in an especially rare move, they also fired tear gas at members of a migrant caravan from Central America, some of whom had begun to rush the fence along the border. And some of those migrants were reported to have thrown rocks and bottles at the border. But was this an appropriate response by Border Patrol, in your view?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's appropriate for migrants to storm our border, but it never should come to this either. And so what we need is an appropriate plan in place that works with the people who could help us resolve this issue. For example, our president, I think, has worked to antagonize virtually everyone that he should be working with so we can resolve the situation in a fair-minded way. But in any event, we also understand that this is a country that holds out great promise to so many who suffer greatly, but nevertheless, they have to make their way into this country through a process that's in place and has worked well for many years.
So what would be the right balance then? As you say, it's not a good situation to have people rushing the border. And on the other hand, I think most folks can also sympathize with the desperation that inspires folks to make that kind of move. So how do we implement an immigration policy, in your view, that sort of reconciles those competing interests?
Well, I don't think we grant legal authority to our military to act as an arm of law enforcement. I think that creates an unnecessarily dangerous step. It's an unnecessarily dangerous step that further threatens to sort of inflame the passions on all sides. So that is not an appropriate step forward. What we really need to do, again, is come up on a bipartisan basis with a comprehensive immigration reform that addresses all of these issues in a responsible way. And we've worked hard over the years to try to do that. When I was first elected to Congress, Senators McCain and Kennedy, now both sadly passed away, you know, had come close to doing that. And that agreement fell apart. And since then, you know, we've seen no real effort to deal with this in a thoughtful way. And it's clearly something we have to do so that we don't have the kinds of situations that are taking place at the border happening.
Do you foresee such an effort in the new term? I mean, we have a divided Congress now with Democrats taking over the House, but Republicans strengthening their majority in the Senate.
They do, but, you know, we always have to create—I think we do have an opportunity. We have to address the Dreamers whose status has not yet been resolved. That's certainly front and center the most important thing we have to do. But now that we are, and the Democrats are in charge in Washington in the House of Representatives, we can craft an approach to immigration reform that then can become the basis for negotiations. And, you know, we'll see what President Trump is willing to do and what our Senate is willing to do. But absent our support, our control of the Democratic House of Representatives, we wouldn't even have that opportunity. So it's an opportunity that we have to take advantage of, and we'll see where it takes us.
One other matter, Congresswoman, before you go. You know, you're wrapping up what will be your final term in Congress, but a lot of your colleagues are going to be gathering on Wednesday and Thursday this week to vote for the next Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi appears poised to become the next Speaker, but there has been a fight within the Democratic Party over whether she is the right person to lead the party. You support her, and why so?
Well, I had the good fortune to be sworn in by the first female Speaker of the House in our country's history. It was a moment I will never forget, and to serve with her as we were in the majority, and I saw her extraordinary abilities to legislate. And I think the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the passage of Dodd-Frank are just two simple examples, not so simple, actually, especially with the Affordable Care Act, and a monumental piece of legislation that is a testament to her ability to hold us as a party together, because we have many different points of view, and these legislative efforts are not simple, and get to a place where we could pass such significant legislation. So I've seen what she can do when we're in the majority. We were, of course, then in the majority with in the House, in the Senate, and had the presidency as well. As we made our way into the minority, I saw the other side of her ability to navigate and leverage what little power we did have, because in the minority, you really lose a lot. And because of her ability to hold everybody together, I think we were able to maximize that leverage to good effect so that we were able to fund the many priorities that Democrats strongly believe in. So I've seen her at work in the majority. I've seen her at work in the minority. I don't see anybody out there who could come remotely close to that ability to legislate and to work with a very diverse caucus. And for that reason, I would heartily vote for her. Now, I do think we're getting to a point where we need to put in place a plan to transition to new leadership and create a mentoring program process, or begin to identify potential leaders of the future. But we're not there at this point, and we have someone who's demonstrated extraordinary capacity. And I wouldn't want to lose the opportunity we have coming out of the gate. It would be a waste of such of that opportunity to fight, have this family fight, and lose that precious time.
Well, could looking forward, though, perhaps mean new faces in the number two and three positions? You know, as you well know, not everyone in the Massachusetts delegation is so high on Pelosi as you, most notably Seth Moulton, has been leading the charge of folks opposed to her speakership. But he signaled today that perhaps he'd be open to a compromise where maybe Steny Hoyer and James Clyburn step aside. They're 79 and 78, respectively, and most likely to be the new majority leader and majority whip. So would that perhaps be a compromise for Democrats, Congresswoman? You know, keep Pelosi, but move on to groom successors at number two and number three.
Well, that may well be a conversation in, you know, this in process. I've worked with all three and have great respect for Mr. Hoyer and Mr. Clyburn as well. But the reality is the world, the Congress needs to reflect the country. We are a very different country than we were so many years ago. It's one of the reasons I chose not to run again, having been a part of the political life of this country, either directly or indirectly, for many, many years. And I realized that, you know, we needed the voices of those who are the product of more recent times. So that's a conversation that's underway.
That is Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas joining us from Lowell. Thank you so much for your time again, Congresswoman.
Thank you. Take care.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. New details are emerging in the Boston Marathon bombing case as attorneys for convicted bomber Jahar Tsarnaev prepare to file their appeal of his death sentence by December 19th. Hundreds of newly unsealed court documents are providing information and insights about a number of aspects of the case. And joining us now for more on the story is Boston Herald reporter Laurel Sweet. Laurel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
So perhaps the most startling information we've learned from these new documents refers to a triple homicide in Waltham in 2011. So this is 2 years before the bombing. And according to the filings, Jahar told a college classmate in 2012 that his older brother Tamerlan, his bombing co-conspirator, had, quote, committed jihad in Waltham. And that college classmate was willing to testify during Jahar's trial, but prosecutors were able to bar any discussion of that triple murder. So first of all, Laurel, can you explain why the defense team would fight to include more details of this brutal killing? Why bring up more bad stuff that the Tsarnaevs maybe did?
I know. It's funny because I can remember the hearing that they held on them wanting to include this in the trial. And as we know now, federal judge George O'Toole refused to allow it to be admitted. But what they were going after and a huge point of their defense was that they wanted to show that Jahar was under the influence of his older brother, that his older brother Tamerlan was the one who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, already a psychotic killer, and that he was just, you know, going along to get along, in effect. And that, you know, they really wanted to hammer home to the jury the brutality of the murders of these three men and what were done to them, which was they were, you know, nearly decapitated and they were bound. But Judge O'Toole would not allow that in, so the jury never heard any of that. And it really weakened their argument in terms of how big a player Jahar was in all of this.
Makes sense once you unpack it, right? And Tamerlan, of course, we should remember, was the older brother who was killed in the shootout in Watertown. And so his younger brother's defense team is effectively willing to throw him under the bus here to make him look like he was really the ringleader. And Laurel, the case remains unsolved. The triple homicide remains unsolved, according to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. But at the time, it was widely considered to just be a drug-related murder. So do we have any idea why Jahar Tsarnaev would have called it a jihad?
Well, no, that didn't come out so much. One of the victims was a very close friend. In fact, some said the best friend of Tamerlan, Brendan Mess. And according to court documents, multiple court documents, The men were considered involved in the drug trade, and one of the bodies had marijuana sprinkled on it. But it looked more of like a drug rip than a just a flat out robbery. So that was a very interesting choice of words, I thought. And it's incredible that it does remain unsolved, even though there is allegedly a written confession out there by another friend of Tamerlan's.
Right. This is Ibrahim Todashev you're talking about, who was being questioned by FBI and state police authorities in Florida. And he was killed during that interrogation about a month after Tsarnaev's arrest. What do we know about Todashev's role in those Waltham killings, Laurel?
Well, supposedly, and there are conflicting reports. Again, this is citing court documents, some that said that he initially came out and said he had nothing to do with it, and then once Tamerlan was dead, he was very quick to implicate him in all of this. Among the unsealed, these court documents that were just unsealed last week, there is a note by the defense that they actually have a copy of the written confession he made before he was killed in his apartment in Florida. And that was found to be self-defense by an FBI agent. And there were two Massachusetts state troopers on hand who obviously were investigating the Waltham triple homicide.
So we have a possible confession from Todashev. We have the willingness of Jahara's college classmate to testify. Is there any other evidence linking Tamerlan Tsarnaev to those Waltham murders?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because we have also now learned that Jahara was apparently willing, as early as October 2013, straight through the trial, he was willing to plead guilty if they took the death sentence off the table. But what the government noted, and we don't know, they sort of described the plea negotiations as torturous and not quite sure. I don't think they ever got beyond draft form, really, because really, what did he have to offer them? But they had hoped to question him about their concerns about there being possibly a larger cell at play here, perhaps bombs that had been hidden that they weren't aware of. And he was just unwilling to cooperate with them, so the whole thing fell apart. But if they had gone through with it, I would have to think that one of the things that he might have cooperated on was what they already knew was his brother's alleged involvement in these murders.
So since his defense team was unsuccessful the first time around in being able to enter information about these Waltham slayings, do we expect a different outcome this time during the appeal, Laurel? I mean, that would seem to be a key point that they would make if they were trying to get him reduced to a life sentence.
Boy, I would certainly think so. I mean, there's so many things that we expect them to hit upon. It's a little bit dicey because it never became evidence in the trial, and I'm not an attorney, let me state that right off the bat. But I think one of the points they might be able to appeal was the Judge O'Toole's ruling that this not be allowed into evidence.
And there's one other tidbit that you picked up, Laurel. You had an interesting piece about the conditions of Jahara's confinement maybe not being quite as austere as prosecutors have made them out to be. Tell us about that.
Yes, I've had many people commenting to me today about how poor their cable system is, apparently, compared to what he has in a Supermax prison. But
50 channels of DirecTV, right?
According to the prosecution, yes. I have not been able to get the Bureau of Prisons to confirm that. They had the prosecution had very much, and this was all done behind closed doors, and I state again that we're just now learning this. They'd very much wanted to be able to tell jurors that if they sentenced him to life, that it wasn't going to be all that bad. The defense wanted them to think that he was being, you know, he'd be barred to a moonscape where he'd never be heard from again, and you know he'd be staring at three walls, and his only view of the outside world would be a window 2 inches wide that's pointed toward the sky. Prosecutors argued that wasn't the case, that he would have access to 50 channels of DirecTV, their words, which he would have complete control over. There'd be yoga instruction. He could listen to music. And the judge did not want any mention of television uttered during testimony. The prosecution did manage to get in the words prison programming, and through a witness, and they were stopped there. And later, as I saw in a transcript from a closed-door meeting with him, he wasn't at all happy with that and was very concerned. And the defense wanted to make an issue of it, too, because he had told them, do not talk about television. But
so
the prosecution felt that, yeah, the jurors wouldn't quite grasp what exactly prison programming was.
Laura, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your time. That's the Boston Herald's Laurel Sweet. There's more Radio Boston ahead. Stick with us. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. A Chinese researcher is claiming that he is responsible for the world's first gene-edited babies, twin girls born this month. The researcher, He Junkui, says he used the gene-editing technique known as CRISPR to modify the embryos of the two babies and give them the ability to resist HIV. The twins, who were conceived through in vitro fertilization, have a father who is HIV positive. He's claim has not been verified, but it has sparked widespread criticism. In fact, his announcement included a response to critics.
I understand my work will be controversial, but I believe family need this technology, and I'm willing to take the criticism for them.
Antonio Regalado is senior editor for biomedicine for the MIT Technology Review, and he's been following the story. He joins us now on the phone. Antonio, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey there.
So could you begin by just telling us, or perhaps reminding some of our listeners briefly, how CRISPR works as a gene editing technique?
Right. CRISPR works with two parts. There's a protein that cuts DNA, and then there's something called a guide RNA, which is a very small molecule that basically matches up with specific places in your genome or in the genome of any cell. And by combining those two things, scientists are able to basically cut DNA, cut the double helix anywhere they want.
And it's a widely accepted and considered quite promising technique, yes? And so could you maybe then fill in why this particular experiment by He is considered so controversial?
Right. CRISPR is widely accepted, widely used. More and more every day, people are editing the genomes of plants to make better plants, goats, cows, zebrafish, yeast. But in this experiment, we're talking about editing the genes of a human embryo and then taking that embryo, transferring it to a woman's uterus and producing a child. So that is a whole different story.
And partly because the alterations then could be inherited from one generation to the next, right? We're not just talking about someone altering his or her own DNA.
Right, exactly. It's called germline engineering. And germline means the cells that do the part that is inheritance, sperm, eggs, and the embryo itself. So when you edit one of those cells and use it to make a person, you've gone germline, or you've crossed the germline, and you've created a change that would be heritable from one generation to the next. And that's why it's a concern, because we're making decisions today for the people of the future.
And some scientists are also concerned about the particular details of the way this experiment by He was conducted. For example, he didn't give notice of his work until long after he began it, just earlier this month. And meanwhile, the children have already been born. And there's some question about how much disclosure he gave to the parents involved. How does that sort of magnify the ethical questions that would be here in any case, Antonio?
Right. Well, very, very little is known about how the experiment was undertaken, and that's the whole problem. This is a question for the whole world to consider, to decide on, and here we have a case of someone who did it in complete secrecy with what appears to be really limited oversight. I think even less is known about the experience of the parents that were involved. We haven't heard from them yet, so we don't know what the researchers told them, what their expectations were, or whether they got what's called informed consent. In other words, a really clear idea of what was going to happen.
So let's get a little bit, Antonio, into how this experiment was supposed to work, what He claims to have done. So some people, a very small number, naturally appear to have a genetic mutation that makes them highly resistant to HIV. And there's a gene called CCR5. That is the gene that CRISPR modifies in this technique. How exactly does it work in this experiment?
Right. It's well known that people who are lacking a working copy of CCR5 are either immune to or highly resistant to to HIV. Actually, there's a very famous case, the Berlin patient, when the whole phenomenon was kind of discovered. This was somebody who had HIV and also had cancer and got a bone marrow transplant. And then, kind of miraculously, he was cured of his HIV, which basically never happens. And it turns out that the bone marrow that he got, the donor didn't have his gene, CCR5. So that's kind of how it was discovered, how the effect was discovered. And so a lot of people have thought for a long time, like, well, gee, would this be an avenue to make people resistant to HIV? And in fact, there's a clinical trial also of gene editing, but in adults, where there's an attempt underway to change their blood cells to remove CCR5. In this case, the researchers just said, well, how about lifelong protection? Why don't we make the child HIV resistant from the get-go?
So in this case, we're talking about how CCR5 affects the HIV virus, but of course, like many genes, it can affect other diseases too. And we've heard some concern from Feng Zhang, who's one of the most prominent CRISPR scientists in the world here at the Broad Institute. And he's pointed out in his Twitter criticism of this experiment that a side effect here possibly could be making patients more susceptible to the West Nile virus, or perhaps more likely to die of flu symptoms. What else do we know or not know about the potential side effects here?
Right. Well, you know, people who don't have this gene seem generally healthy. I actually hadn't heard about the West Nile virus before earlier today when I heard about it from Feng Zeng, that maybe if you don't have this gene, you could be more susceptible to certain other types of infections. Certainly possible. But I think the big point is this team in China, they took totally normal embryos and mutated them. You know, they damaged those embryos in order to get this anti-HIV effect. So the biggest risk of all is introducing CRISPR into the embryo. It may do what you want, but sometimes it has a propensity to do some other things that you don't want, make mutations elsewhere in the genome, and you might not see those until the kid was born, and those could cause even bigger problems.
And I should point out, too, Antonio, as you probably know, that we've also heard a different perspective from another prominent CRISPR scientist, George Church at Harvard. While raising some qualms about the specific way that this trial was conducted, has said that he thinks that a cause like combating HIV justifies a controversial experiment like this one. So there does seem to be sort of an ethical split in the scientific community, Antonio, and I wonder what that says about the broader debate that is going to go on now and will continue about the ethics of modifying embryos.
Right. Well, you know, we just learned about this yesterday, so today everybody's really concerned about it, and there's a lot of sort of negative assessments of this research. I think George Church is somebody who looks sort of further in the future, and he realizes that attitudes could change. As we get used to these ideas, it might not seem so shocking, and we might come around to the notion that, gee, maybe some of these things really are good. And I can tell you, he's not just thinking about HIV. I mean, there's other things you could do to a human embryo which might have really interesting consequences. What happens if you could make people live 200 years instead of 100 years? They can do it to worms by changing their DNA. Maybe they could do it to us. If you start to think about longevity, then you could see how this whole idea gets really, really interesting.
And gets even more controversial, no doubt. And Huff seems to be at least self-aware about the controversy that would be generated. And he's talked a little bit about this. Here's a little bit of him discussing how there would be inevitable controversy about gene editing, even if he wasn't the one doing the work.
The world has moved on to the stage for embryo gene editing. There will be someone somewhere who's doing this. If it's not me, it's someone else.
So, Antonio, in the final moments that we have, I mean, what about that argument that, yes, I understand there's going to be some controversy here, but this is inevitable. This is where science is headed, and we got to figure out what to do with it. We can't stop it.
Right. That's the message from the scientists. That's the message generally from the scientific community as a whole. It really is. Things are rushing forward, and there's no way to contain them. But on the other hand, you know, this person has stepped forward. He's done the experiment. There is a controversy. He's at the center of it. So let's not forget that there is an aspect here of seeking fame, seeking renown, seeking a Nobel Prize. Scientists want recognition for their work, and they want to be famous.
Right.
And I think that's part of what we're seeing here.
All right. That's Antonio Regalado, Senior Editor for Biomedicine at the MIT Technology Review. Antonio, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, man. Thanks. Bye.
And NPR is reporting that a Chinese ethics board will investigate to see whether He's experiment violated the country's laws. And we turn now to some other breaking news from just this last hour.
Touchdown confirmed. Yeah. Those
are some very happy scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, cheering as the NASA spacecraft InSight landed on Mars. The spacecraft set off 6 months ago and traveled 300 million miles. Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, has been following the story and joins us now via Skype. Kelly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you so much.
So I know you were watching and listening today. What was your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that anytime you can get down on Mars in one piece, it's a good day. You know, the decades of exploration of Mars are littered with spacecraft that didn't make it. This particular one, for example, inherited hardware from a mission called Mars Polar Lander, which was supposed to land in 1999. It disappeared without a trace, and we still don't know what happened to it.
Well, that sort of helps explain why Jim Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, was talking about how emotional and how happy these people were today when InSight did finally touch down on Mars.
Well, absolutely. I'll tell you, it was intense, and you could feel the emotion. It was very, very quiet when it was time to be quiet, and of course, very celebratory with every little new piece of information that was received.
So, Kelly, I mean, there's a lot of work to come, but there was no guarantee that they would even get to do that work today.
That's right. And you know, the thing is, the entry and landing is very compressed, very concentrated, and very dangerous, and completely done by remote control. Mars is too far away, 8 minutes each way as the light travels. So there was no way to joystick it down to the surface. It all had to be automated, and it all had to work just right. And apparently it did. We've already seen one crude picture from the lander that shows a very flat landscape, which is exactly what they were hoping for.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what work is going to go on now. And we've landed objects on Mars before, Kelly, so what's different this time? What is InSight going to do that sets it apart from past explorations of Mars?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the first time, we're going to get try to probe inside Mars as opposed to seeing its surface. You know, a great party question for someone is, how many spacecraft do we have at Mars right now? Well, the answer is we have 6 orbiters and 1 rover. So all of those are just analyzing the surface. InSight will probe the interior in ways that we've never been able to do before, using a combination of a seismometer to check for Mars quakes and also a heat probe to try to determine how much heat is coming up from inside Mars.
Okay, so there's a new term, Mars quakes. What's the significance of those? What are those going to tell us about the planet?
Yeah, so that we can this detector, you know, we landed a seismometer on Mars in 1976, if you could believe it, but it didn't work very well because it wasn't sensitive enough. This one will be able to detect really small things. So, for example, Mars is gradually shrinking as its interior cools, so the crust will crack and crinkle, and we'll pick those up. Every time a big meteorite hits Mars, we'll pick that up. We'll even be able to detect the tides that are created in the crust of Mars by one of its moons, Phobos, as it goes around. All of these will be a probe of the inside of Mars, the mantle, the core, places that we just have never been able to get a handle on before.
All right, so this is all extremely fascinating to folks like you, Kelly. But what about to the space agnostic crowd? You know, maybe who don't have a space trivia as their party icebreakers. Why should they care? I mean, what are we going to learn about Earth from studying Mars in this way?
Yeah. So, well, guess what? Earth is a really complicated planet. It's got a lot going on. It's got plate tectonism, where the crustal plates are shifting around. The mantle is churning inside. We've got a magnetic field. We've got stuff growing on the outside. Mars is a terrestrial planet that is much, much simpler, both inside and out. And so by understanding the inside of Mars, which has largely remained undisturbed since it formed 4.5 billion years ago, unlike the Earth, we hope to get a handle on what those conditions were, how the planets came together. Is the core of Mars liquid? Does it consist of metal? These are things we don't know. By understanding Mars, we can mirror that information back to Earth and get a better handle on how our planet came to be and how it got the way it is.
And of course, this was a NASA mission, but there are private enterprises as well, right? Notably, the aerospace company SpaceX, run by Elon Musk, is developing technology that could, say, one day enable a human to land or maybe even live on Mars, Kelly. I mean, could the findings of this mission give us any clues about the likelihood of that happening?
Incrementally, but I want to step back. This is a NASA mission, InSight is, but it's two main experiments. The seismometer was built in France, and the heat probe was built in Germany. So this really is an international undertaking. And I think down the road, to your point, we're going to see a much broader coalition of space forces, be they private or governmental, international. If we ever decide that we want to go back to Mars to stay, to have people there, it's going to be take a really deep pockets. And that's the only way you can really get that is by having this multinational, multi-platform kind of approach.
And in our closing moments, Kelly, what's the next step? When's InSight going to come back home?
Yeah, so InSight will never come back. It will call home. It already has done that. The next step is to deploy its solar panels. And, you know, this spacecraft is about the size of a large office desk, but it's got these big wings to collect electricity. It won't be until next March that we actually start to get the data that the scientists are hoping for.
All right. That is senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, Kelly Beatty. Kelly, thank you very much for your insight.
A pleasure always.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.